Book Review, Fukuoka's One Straw Revolution. I first read Fukuoka's best-known book at the beginning of my farming journey, so I thought it was time to give it another look. The book covers a range of topics, often jumping between them, so I divided this post up into three sections focusing on particular aspects of the work. Part 1. Fukuoka's Philosophy. Fukuoka talks about how humanity knows nothing at all, in which he includes himself. The harder we work to understand the world by breaking it down into smaller parts, the further we move from glimpsing the whole. Fukuoka states, "The geography and topography of the land, the condition of the soil, its structure, texture and drainage, exposure to sunlight, insect relationships, the variety of seed used, the method of cultivation, truly an infinite variety of factors must all be considered. A scientific testing method which takes all relevant factors into account is an impossibility." This overlaps with my idea of irreducible complexity, that living systems have so many intersecting variables that it is a waste of time and energy to explain or understand anything in detail. In living systems, our explanations, even if somewhat correct, are incomplete because there are always more variables that have gone unnoticed. Trial and error are the only tools we need, and success is the ability to move from one failure to the next possibility with no reduction in enthusiasm. Fukuoka also rejects the discrimination between natural and unnatural, and I suspect would feel the same way about the more recent ideas of native versus exotic or invasive. He readily embraced an imported Australian acacia into his orchards since it hosted aphids all year round, boosting predator populations that helped control citrus pests. Part 2. Yields and EROEI. Fukuoka reported yields of 550 kilograms of rice on his quarter-acre grain field, and as much again of winter barley and wheat. With 15,000 kilojoules per kilogram, that gave an annual output of 16.5 million kilojoules of food energy per year, enough to supply humans that need 10,000 kilojoules of energy per day, with 1,650 days worth of energy. A typical Japanese peasant diet gets about half of their energy from rice and wheat, so this quarter acre was enough to support 9 people with access to a balanced diet. This is about what Fukuoka claimed, with his farm supposedly supporting himself and another 4 to 5 permanent workers, plus additional people who stayed for shorter periods. Fukuoka also mentioned workers harvesting many vegetables from the farm and seafood from local sources. The EROEI, the energy return on energy invested, of his grain growing is also worth analysing, and we will convert figures to a 1-acre scale with one person working. He reports it took about a day to prepare the grain for sowing by coating it in clay pellets and a few hours to broadcast, so let's estimate 4 days for him to sow 1 acre. The crop is not fertilised or weeded, just flooded at select times to weaken the ground cover. Maintaining paddy walls and flooding would take maybe another 8 days per year. Harvesting rice takes about 120 hours per acre, so doubling that to 60 days of work for both crops. The grain must be hung and dried, then threshed. For wheat, threshing by hand takes about an hour per bushel, or 27 kilos, so threshing out the total yield of 2,200 kilograms on this acre would take 80 hours, or another 10 days. Each acre of crops then takes 67 days of labour to produce, to give 6,600 days worth of energy. This gives an astonishing time-equivalent energy return on energy invested of 98, vastly more than enough to sustain a significantly complex society that has ample time left over for the development of specialist activities. Each acre could then theoretically support around 36 people who rely on it for 50% of their calories. The claimed number of people per acre is a lot higher than that reported in the book Farmers for 40 Centuries, with about 1/3 of an acre of grain per person across the entirety of pre-industrial Japan. And this makes me question if Fukuoka's figures are accurate, though this is consistent with his belief that even pre-industrial agriculture in Japan was operating far below biological potential. Agriculture in pre-industrial Japan seems to have been limited by phosphorus in most locations, so perhaps Fukuoka's quarter acre had inadvertently benefited from a history of synthetic phosphorus application before he began his experimental farming work. Fukuoka pointed out that at the time of publication, in the 1970s, there was about one quarter of an acre of arable land per person in Japan. So he claimed there was enough for the nation to support itself, provided the majority returned to natural farming. After World War II, over 70% of the population was still in agriculture. Today, it is under 4%. At the time One Straw Revolution was published, Japan had a population of 100 million, peaking recently at 120 million, and this is now rapidly declining. That does make you wonder why the population of Japan was around 40 million in 1880, if people were already farming naturally. As suggested in Farmers for 40 Centuries, it is probable that access to protein from seafood, or firewood for cooking, were the real limiting resources for pre-industrial society, rather than calories from grain. Part 3. Main Principles. It is worth taking time to compare the main principles of Fukuoka's approach with how my own experimental farming has evolved. The first principle is no cultivation or ploughing. I totally agree here that plant roots and soil organisms do a far superior job of building soil structure than human hands can ever achieve. My early experiments digging in compost gave a quick burst of growth, but then the soil collapsed into a worse state than it was when I began. Digging with your own labour is also physically demanding and wears down the joints. Fukuoka's second principle is no chemical fertiliser or prepared compost. Fukuoka observed even applying a light dusting of ash to his grain fields wiped out spider populations. He does apply a little poultry manure when he lays down straw in the fields to accelerate decomposition. I agree with his disdain for the busy work of composting, preferring to allow materials to decompose naturally in place, ideally from materials that are also grown in place. I have found that field and staple crops are capable of growing better in land that is cycled through fallow periods, and that crops that produce biomass to return to the field, along with lower extractable yields, such as canna, are a more self-sustaining crop than those that do not, such as potatoes, which demand additional spaces put aside for fallow rotations or biomass crops, and hence their higher yields per acre are actually an illusion. I see fertilizer as a waste product created by some other part of the system, such as ash from cooking fires or manure from animals, that needs to go somewhere, so it may as well go into a small area devoted to greedy crops, rather than seeing fertilizer as a foundation for fertility on larger scales. The third principle is no weeding, either by tillage or herbicides. I'm leaning towards this being true, with a few caveats for my local conditions. Well-managed weeds are often superior to mulch, but not all weeds are equally worthwhile, so some effort should be applied to discourage troublemakers while managing the moderately annoying weeds and even encouraging the best ones. Fukuoka also used brief flooding to weaken his weed and cover crops enough to allow his rice to establish. This isn't an option in all locations, including my own, so other appropriate methods for imposing selective disturbance are needed. Other than hand weeding, Inga alleys and penned geese have worked really well for me in the past, and I hope to use them more in the future. The fourth principle is no dependence on chemicals. Fukuoka accepted that weak plants attract pests and diseases, often noting that diseases swept through his district only to leave his crops untouched, and I've seen similar things take place in my experience. He did, however, use an oil emulsion on his citrus scale problems, but he noted that it only became an issue when the overstory trees in his orchard were thinned out, and this reflects that many fruit trees are in fact understory trees by nature. I agree with this principle as well. Even if the sprays and barriers succeed, food that needs to be rescued from pests and diseases is not worth eating. Conclusion. In the context of a rapidly industrializing agricultural system, Fukuoka was a truly remarkable visionary who lived a life himself that he believed in. He persistently experimented with different approaches for many decades, constantly asking, "What if I don't do this or don't do that?" rather than adding more layers of complexity to an already complex pre-industrial subsistent agricultural system. When I look at popular permaculture today, with its dependence on industrial inputs, gadgets, and promises of quick and easy solutions, I wonder what Fukuoka would think. I suspect he would say nothing and simply retreat to his mud-walled hut. I can highly recommend anyone interested in permaculture read this very accessible foundation work that was a key influence to later thinkers such as Mollison and Holmgren, who were more focused on compiling a long list of useful techniques and principles. It is also worth noting that Fukuoka warned people to not simply imitate the methods that worked for him, but rather that they needed to go back to basic observation and experimentation with their own particular patch of land. A student who studied under Fukuoka for years ignored this advice and tried to recreate his system in a different part of Japan. This effort failed completely. He ignored his master's first lesson that everyone needs to start from scratch when they inhabit a particular part of the world. The answers you seek are not in any book, but in the land itself. Fukuoka merely shared the story of how he learnt to read his particular patch of land. If we are seeking sustainable solutions rather than quick ones, we would all do better to embrace this difficult truth. The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.